To set the stage, PGA Tour has been governed as a nonprofit for its entire existence, continues to be where most of the assets sit. Now they have a new for-profit entity, PGA Tour Enterprises, with a separate board.
Most of the assets will sit with the nonprofit part of this deal. It's funny, I spoke to a common friend of ours.
Right now.
And that's, I think, the key question that one, a friend of ours, who's at one of these invest PE types who sits on a lot of boards, including chairs, a few of them, it's like it all comes down to what assets sit in what part of the structure. That's the question like he was most curious to ask to catch up on this stuff, is like, that's the determination. Because there need to be enough assets in the for-profit side to give everyone a return,
right?
But if you do it too much, then you lose the original structure of the tour. So now you've got this like for-profit within a nonprofit.
I'm Roberto.
And I'm Dan. On the Course Record Show, we talk about the business of golf.
We discuss the trends, insights, and strategies defining the industry now and into the future. Welcome back to the Course Record Show, episode 34. We talk business of golf. Roberto here, Dan here. We'll get right into it. A lot of news recently in the golf business. So Dan, what's the latest?
Players Championship just ended, including a presser with Jay. He talked about how the SSG is now in the game. The PGA Tour Enterprises now has a board. Shout out to Joe Ogilvie, our friend of the show, for being named player liaison.
Yep.
And we know there's been a big meeting in the Bahamas between the PIF, some of the players, and the tour. I've got all kinds of ideas and images running through my mind, and I'm dying to see some pictures.
Pictures would be amazing. The way it all went down, you know, there was kind of like the Saturday rumors. There's going to be a big meeting in Ponte Vedra. And then there's like the Monday Twitterati that people, you know, these accounts that track tail numbers realize that the meeting is taking place in the Bahamas. And only one thing comes to mind: Succession, right?
100%.
It's a bunch of jets flying into the Bahamas. It's a fleet of black Range Rovers picking everyone up. It's, you know, linen clothing, you know, a great linen shirt on a yacht. I'm sure this meeting was on some boat, on some floating vessel. I mean, you just can't make this stuff up. It's just too good. Who are the characters, though? Map it to Succession. So let's just go through them quick. Lightning round to start, just for fun. Who do you have as Logan?
Yasser Al-Ramayan, ruthless.
All right. Who is the Tom Wamsgans of this whole golf saga?
Friend of the show, Joe Ogilvie. Outsider turns insider, may end up ruling the world.
I like it. All right. Obvious next one, Cousin Greg.
Peter Malnati. Peppy Peter, the one and only. Really wants to be in, but just talks his way right out of the circle. And
just shows up wearing the wrong suit. His girlfriend has a huge handbag. Just can't quite play the part. Is that what you're saying?
And plays a yellow ball, yes.
And plays... All right, let's go to the siblings. Who is the Shiv?
Pat Cantlay. Talks big game, puffs out his chest, but ultimately over his skis.
Oh, boy. Kendall.
Jay Monahan. A lot of ups and downs.
Just been through a lot.
A lot. The strong desire to please and will die if he can't have control. That's the quote from the finale that most stuck with me.
All right, what about Roman?
Greg, the white shark, Norman. CEO, but wild and calculated, yet charming and right about a lot of things, but just goes about it the wrong way.
Yeah, he has it, but he just can't quite get out of his own way. All right, Connor.
Phil Mickelson.
Wild card.
Just, you never know what you're going to get.
Yeah, never know if he's going to run for president or start a coffee company. All right, underrated character, Stewie.
Great character. Stewie's going to be one of the SSG guys in the end. Sharp, clever, calculated, cutthroat. This only really plays out if someone gets backstabbed the way it does in the show. But, you know, that's my prediction.
All right. And then some a little bit more minor characters. Jerry. Who's the Jerry?
Tiger Woods. Always in the game, even though they kind of ultimately want them out and want to move past that era. And a little bit of a naughty side.
Yeah. And what about Mattson?
John Rahm.
Oh.
Smart.
Foreign invader.
Smart. Maybe a little too clever by half. Wants his cake and eat it too, and tries to play the highest upside game.
That's Mattson. All right, what about Carl?
Toss up between Ron Price, who's the COO of the PGA Tour, and Jimmy Dunn, who's an investor turned PGA Tour board director,
experienced, old hands, like been through the corporate wars,
credible, avoid the limelight, behind the scenes, are just ruthless, independent movers.
Okay, I like it. That scene where Carl tells Tom on the plane in that last season where he's like, "You are right and properly effed," is the funniest. That's one of my absolute favorite scenes of Succession. But in all seriousness, like you said, Joe Ogilvie has a board seat on the existing PGA Tour nonprofit board and a board seat on the PGA Tour Enterprises. He has a title as player liaison. I mean, who has most to gain in kind of this new setup with SSG and potentially PIF? Joe seems to be on that list. Who else has a lot to gain?
Yeah, I think Joe's got a lot to gain, like you just said. By the way, if you want to get a good deep dive at Joe, episodes 1 and 23 of this show are with Joe Ogilvie. One, he talks about a lot of things that are relevant to this conversation, his take on the business of pro golf. 23 sort of takes a different departure, and we have a little bit more fun with them. But if you want to get a deeper dive on Joe, highly recommend our own podcast, episode 1 and 23. So check it out.
Yeah, no, a key player in the golf industry now, and a couple hours of pretty compelling conversation we had with him. So appreciate him joining us. But I enjoyed those conversations. Who else?
I think there's something here to be had for the DP World Tour.
Yeah,
like only because they've really lost a lot of status in the game the last few years. And, you know, it sounds like if this deal with the PIF comes, ergo comes a world tour. And I think the DP World Tour has the most to gain in that, given that their players are most worldwide and they've got the most worldwide tour already. I think that has to be a good tailwind for the DP World Tour.
Okay. Any other winners?
I think the Ryder Cup. I mean, the Ryder Cup right now has gotten... I mean, it's still great, the best event, so don't get me wrong.
Yeah, what upside does the Ryder Cup have?
I just think it becomes now a place, a meeting point for the best players, much like the majors.
Yeah.
With the beauty of the Ryder Cup, right? It's been very tragic that we haven't been able to see the best European players play because of the stipulation. And, you know, sure, some of them are not the best options for the team, and they may buy just fine in Rome. But you know, I think if they want to have I want Bethpage to be competitive. I don't care who wins. And that happens when we get the best Euro players going.
Yeah. All right. Most to lose in this kind of new setup.
I had a few in no particular order. First one is our Jerry comp, Tiger Woods. Like, why would you put yourself through this? Like, there's so much to be had here, and like just so much politicking and crap to do with these deals. Just ask your buddy Rory. Right.
Yeah.
That wasn't a great experience. So I don't know why Tiger would do it.
Yeah. All right. Who else? I've got one.
Greg Norman. I don't think there's a need for two CEOs, even if LIV and the PGA Tour coexist. Norman's been a great wartime CEO of like picking a fight and rallying the troops. I don't think a peacetime CEO looks like the shark.
Yeah, that's fair. The other one that comes to mind is middle of the mall players, right? I mean, the purses have gone up so high. You've doubled purses, so everyone wins there, even if you're not one of the top 25 players. I mean, it's still a huge windfall. But, you know, if you're talking about rethinking the whole system and they see value at the top, if you were a guy who lived in that 75 to 125 or part of the tour, you could see, I think, equal amount of like earnings opportunity over a 10-year career or a 15-year career. Like, you might make the same amount of money. You know, your up years, you make a bunch more. You might fall down a little harder if they tighten up the top 125 or whatnot. But that just kind of living in that range where you're playing your 28 events and have a steady run outside the limelight could be a tougher gig to get if they shake things up.
Is that the right direction for the tour to go in? I mean, you've been,
I think it is if it is mobile, like if you can drop down, but also play well and get back up. Like if you want to go to a top 100 tour or a top 80 tour as fully exempt, that's fine. But you know, the level below needs to have some access to get up there. You can't just give those 50 spots, you know, in perpetuity to the top 50 guys. There's got to be a path to the top. And I've heard a little bit of Joe's stuff, and I think that's something that he understands well, and will I think we'll bring that to the table. So,
yeah. Okay.
All right. Let's talk about the players from a business standpoint. Obviously, from a golf standpoint, it was incredible to watch. I mean, you got, you know, Scheffler with the neck, and Wyndham. I mean, it literally comes down to the last putt, right?
Nasty lip out.
Nasty lip out. Yeah. So you got perfect weather. You've got a tight leaderboard. You got three of the top 10 players in the world. Comes down to the last putt. And Sunday, 300,000 more people watched NASCAR than watched the PGA Tour. So all four rounds, the ratings were down from 2023. What gives? Like, what? Why do you think that is?
I mean, I think much like you and I have said, people might be kind of tired of watching of like the drama that's going on with the tour, right? I mean, the first few events haven't given people a lot to look forward to. They've been a bit of snoozy before the players.
Yeah.
They may not have given it a chance is one thing. And people just have a lot of options of stuff to watch, and it's only increasing. And we're like in mid season for a lot of stuff right now.
Right.
And so I think there's an abundance of options. It's really hard to sit down and watch in the middle of the day. I mean, that's not new for golf, but I think it just compounds with the abundance of other options. That's my take. Do you have any other explanations?
I have two. One is ties into yours, and that's the options. Like the YouTube golf thing and the YouTube content people and the, you know, golf influencers. I mean, we've kind of tracked it on this show, but I think it's reaching like a critical mass. I mean, I played golf with someone recently who's like a core golfer, right? Single digit handicap, you know, in their 40s. And he told me, like, hey, you know, like if I'm trying to kill time or just unwind, like I watch this stuff now. Like it's entertaining. These guys are funny. Like it's pretty, you know, whether the videos are 15 minutes or 60 minutes or an hour. And yeah, you probably got some, you know, advertisements clipped in. And I was like, wow. Like this is really reaching like a broader audience than the stereotypical, like, you know, 17-year-old high school kid who wants to watch the good guys yuck it up. And it just goes to the point that you can get your golf fix in a number of different places. It doesn't have to be on Sunday afternoon on CBS and NBC. So that I thought was one. And the second, I mean, I joke with people. I can show you the text chains. I bought all the Scheffler stock you can buy for the last 6 years. I mean, he is phenomenal. He's a role model. If I could cash that stock in, I could retire, because he's turned out to be, you know, the best player in, you know, 10 or 15 years, probably at least the best couple year run. But as a star, as like a TV entertainment product, you know, it's the numbers are kind of showing, like maybe he's not the biggest TV draw. You know, I want my kids to watch his interviews, and like, he is a role model for like me and young people. Like he's just a 10 out of 10, but from a pure product standpoint, could be, you know, maybe not the most star, not the brightest star that we've had in golf.
It's tricky, right? There's this big balance in like society and public figures, right? Where people want people to be more genuine, but the risk of being genuine and getting, you know, canceled or backlash or offending people is so tough. Right. And I don't mean, one, Scotty seems super grounded and very wholesome to begin with, but I'm sure he's very smart about how to pick his spots in a lot of
things. He actually said that in an interview this week.
Did he?
Yeah, he alluded to something like that where he said, you know, I watch myself in here. There's just a lot of, to the effect of that. I don't know exactly what the words were.
Yeah, there's very little gain. And look, I mean, you can be really successful and really good and really rich without all the extra fame baggage that comes. I mean, sounds amazing, right? Sounds right. Like the best of everything.
Yeah.
To your YouTube thing, I mean, you describe me in a way, right? I didn't think about this till now, but I do watch more. I have more watch time of golf on YouTube than I do on the big tube.
Right. That's wild. That's crazy to me.
Yeah, and I've watched golf a little bit on the screen, like a final round on Sunday. I try to get my boys to watch so they can be exposed to it, and like, they usually have their attention span is usually short. They want to go away, but they were locked in on the players, right?
Were
it
they?
Was like,
yeah,
they were really locked in. And so I think that's, if the tour, I know it's really hard to replicate great finishes. Like there's no formula for it. It just needs to play out.
Right.
Obviously having the best players helps, but the, but yeah, like that, if we can get more lightning in the bottle like that more often, that bodes well, I think, for the viewership that you numbers that you mentioned.
Yeah. And I know it was three of the top 10 at the end there, and they would have all been in the signature events. And it's not really the focus for our podcast, but having a cut and having a full field makes for better golf tournaments. End of story. If you want to improve your product, getting the top 50 guys there or the top 80 and leaving everyone else out and having no cut, it dilutes your product. It just does. So, you know, I thought that was a great data point. Like Scheffler's there every week. If it was a 6-person or 600-person field, he's going to be there. But there's just something about the nature of the competition that creates these finishes and more crowded leaderboards. And you saw it. So, yeah, really cool. I loved watching it too. It was awesome. Sawgrass is, I mean, it's one of my personal favorites, but it's great for the entertainment. All right. I think you had a couple other just like quick hits after the play.
Couple notes. I saw this meme, I guess, going around that Ted Scott, Scheffler's caddy, has made more money the last 2 weeks than Rory has all season.
Oh,
and what's the caddy's take for a win? Like 10%?
10%, yeah.
Yeah. So he's out earning Rory 10x in less time, which is just I mean, I guess that unintentionally throwing shade at Rory there too. But just bananas how those signature events of their purchases have gotten crazy. And you know, being along for the ride on a good bag never hurts.
Oh my gosh. All right. Anything else from players?
Yeah. The last one is, I mean, seem to have great reactions from people on site and great reactions from people watching it because the telecast seems to have really nailed it this time. So it's been really fun to see that, but I'm obviously the execution of the event was great. And like we said, the lightning in the bottle in terms of a great finish, but to me, it's like, it feels like the whole overbearance of really trying to be that fifth major. It was almost like propagandist for a while. And it feels like they kind of dropped the act and just like took some starch off the collar in that. And I think people are now like, oh, I can see past that. And I can just see right. the event for what it is and appreciate it.
Right.
I think there's versus the automatic pushback that the fifth major label just kind of creates for folks. Do you have any take on that?
I think from a brand perspective, they lean more into it being the PGA Tour's flagship event, right? Like, and that's what it is. And that's what it always has been. And that's saying that like, hey, we're a world-class organization and this is our best event. As opposed to saying we're a world-class organization, but we want to have one thing be as good as those other things. And it's just a different message. And I agree with you. There wasn't as much banter about it and they didn't talk about it on live from and it just is unnecessary. So yeah, it's a good call out.
Yeah.
All right. I know we want to talk a little bit more about the board governance, but let's hit two other quick business of golf things. One, rumors flying that Callaway Top Golf is going to spin out the equipment part. So Callaway, we talked about this on the last episode. Nike shut down their hard goods. TaylorMade spun out their hard goods. And now looks like Callaway might be next. Any thought to that?
Was not aware, but that sounds, it's interesting, right? It's just a reversal in direction where they were sort of consolidating Travis yeah. Matthew and then Top Golf and other brands. So it's,
it seems like nobody wants to be in the hard goods business.
It's a hard business. Goods are hard. I don't know. I mean, I looked at some of the, like a Acushnet's earnings came out maybe a month ago or so.
Yeah.
And like they're killing it. Right. And it's mostly hard goods there. And
Golf balls or clubs or both?
Well, club balls are up 12% in revenue. Clubs are up 8%.
That's good.
I mean, so pretty strong. And the profitability continues to be strong. So I have not looked at Callaway's earnings, but the, you know, if Titleist is any indication, there's health in the business right now.
Yeah, and they do similar numbers on, I think actually Callaway Golf Clubs does a bit more revenue than Titleist, but they're way back. And I think they're number two golf ball, but distant second. So
yeah,
it'd be interesting to watch that unfold. The other one that was in the news was the drama on the Los Angeles public golf scene. So This
is so sad and kind of funny at the same time.
You have to laugh a little bit. Yeah. Right? So yeah. A little bit of background. One of our first five or six episodes, we talked to Brian Ferris, who owns a golf course. Check out that episode because he talks about the rise of like Golf Now and last minute tee time and the online booking platforms.
And taking his club from private to semi-private.
That's right. So fast forward 2024, LA Public Golf is run on Golf Now, and a black market has emerged for tee times. So basically, if you log on at like 6 o'clock in the morning, 9 days before premium tee times come out, they're already all sold out. And apparently these brokers, black market brokers, are selling the tee times at a markup. But the best part is there's an investigation underway. The best part is the quote from the article said, there's this guy, and the only way you can get in touch with him to get a tee time is through a Korean messaging app called Kakao. And that's when I just was like, wow, this is rich. So what would you do if you lived in Los Angeles?
I mean, I don't know.
Korean or what?
I don't know. I guess I'd have to find a way to book my golf through Not Golf Now. But look, it's sad. I think, you know, we've been talking a lot about the sustainability of the golf boom that COVID has brought.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's hard to increase supply of courses. So you really want to maximize what you got, right? So these LA public courses like Griffin Park, et cetera, like Max Homa learned to play this stuff, right? Like they have an important place in the game. And they charge a very, very cheap $35 a round. So you've essentially just 2x now the cost of the round.
Yeah, because that's what they were saying. They're not selling them for $500. They're marking them up like 10, 20, 30 bucks. That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. But if it goes from 35 to 75, hey, that's over time that adds up to someone who is making ends meet. So,
well, forget the money. If you can't play, if you can't get on the Korean messaging app, you can't play even for any price.
Yeah. So that's another. So, I mean, look, I mean, good business is going to bring good and bad actors. So, like,
right,
in one way, this is not surprising. But yeah, I mean, it just stinks for that person who, you know, we talked in this show before how a lot of people learned or picked up the game for the first time off of green grass.
Yeah. Right?
Like a very natural evolution was to go to a muni, right? Not join a club.
Yeah.
And, you know, the clubs in LA are just really hard to get into, period. So, like, the idea of like this not being an access point to graduate that golfer into a green grass golfer is sad to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's being addressed. I think this was like some subcommittee of a subcommittee where it was brought up. It'll be an interesting one to follow, especially we don't really go into the politics here, but I can only imagine the level of bureaucracy in like the California public parks system that will have to be navigated to figure out how this gets resolved. So somebody else's problem, not mine, but a pretty interesting story.
Well, we'll continue to watch this space.
We'll be tracking the situation. This episode is sponsored by Holderness and Born. The cool thing they have going on hbgolf.com right now are small collections around the US Open and the PGA Championship. So even if you can't make it to Pinehurst or Louisville, you can get the merch for these events. The US Open logo is awesome. That famous Pinehurst putter boy rocking the bucket hat, holding a flag. It's really good. There's 4 or 5 polos, a quarter zip, a hoodie, a vest, and a couple hats that you can get with each the US Open and PGA Championship logos. Check that out along with the bigger spring collection, including the popular pants and shorts. If you haven't tried H&B bottoms yet, definitely check them out. hbgolf.com. Let's talk about something that we have been kicking around back and forth. So we each took it upon ourselves to do a little bit of research on board governance. So in general, not just on the PGA Tour, but to set the stage, PGA Tour has been governed as a nonprofit for its entire existence. They had a board that was independent directors, and now they have a new for-profit entity, PGA Tour Enterprises, with a separate board. So it just got me doing a little bit of research, like, hey, what's the baseline? So I'll just give some facts. Nonprofits typically do not compensate their board directors. Public companies do. Fortune 100 average comp per director is a little over $300,000. For the Russell 2000, which are, you know, a little bit smaller companies, but still really big publicly traded companies, Board comp around 200,000 per director. There can be some kickers per meeting, or if you lead a certain committee, you know, maybe get a little bit more. And that comp, interestingly, is about 2/3 in equity shares and about 1/3 in cash. So, you know, you're aligning incentives, right? The board directors, if they're given equity, you know, grow the value of the business, grow the value of their piece. So, what am I missing as far as just setting the stage? And then we can kind of get into some of the other, you know, tenets of good board governance that we uncovered.
No, all that's correct, factually correct. But the compensation is not the reason people join boards.
Right. So why?
I think two biggest use cases. One, if you're an executive that's been C-level executive for a while at a particularly a big company, and you're looking to wind down from that, like you hear sort of people retiring cold turkey and going nuts, right? Like they just don't, they need the juice, right?
Right.
Like the same way a pro athlete does when they retire. So this is a good way to say, okay, I'm not going to work 80 hours a week the way I used to, but like I still stay in the game and it's still satisfying. Maybe I can mentor someone and I can stay in the game in some way.
Stay relevant.
Yeah. Stay relevant. So that's one thing, is like that semi-retirement path. Two is maybe you're not done in the rat race yet, but you're between jobs. You're an exec between jobs. And again, you want to keep cutting your teeth and staying relevant, but with the intention of coming back into the main stage as a, you know, hotshot somewhere else. So I think those are the two biggest use cases that people go and do it. Like, consider this as a parallel, right? This isn't a board, but think of all the investors on the show Shark Tank.
Yeah.
Right. The Mark Cubans of the world. Like, they get $20,000 per episode to shoot all day. Yeah. I mean, it's hardly worth their time from that perspective.
Right.
But to them, it's like probably a lot of fun. They get to promote their image, access to great deals and boards, right? The people in the business call it some form of proprietary deal flow, right? They get a lot of halo effects from that that they don't get explicitly compensated for as part of being on camera. So that I think of that as a potential comp for what is motivating folks on these boards.
Yeah. And then the other thing to call out is, you know, private companies, it's kind of a black box. Some massive private companies I read frequently govern similar to a public company, but then you can have family run companies that have small boards. It can be kind of anything in the private company world, which is pretty interesting. Some other research. So I read like a Gartner article that was like, here are the four keys to like a successful board governance. And then like, of course I read a McKinsey paper and it was like, oh my gosh, this is super complicated. I don't want to be on a board. It was like breaking it out, but it's, you know, it's a commitment. And every, I think across the board, people underestimate the commitment of time and energy it is to serve on a board. About 250 hours was what one Gartner research said we're talking bigger companies here. The other trends I found, consumer behavior is the most significant change recently that boards are dealing with. Extreme rise of cybersecurity risk. I actually didn't click the link, but I saw that like there's some SEC mandates or some regulatory mandates coming down about cybersecurity that companies will have to comply with. And then digital being a big, big focus. So these are the issues that boards are dealing with right now. But quarterly meetings, you know, strategy, audit, what are the committees, like the typical ones? Compensation is a big one.
Yeah. I think in a public company, there's two committees you'll find in almost every board. One is the compensation committee, especially for CEO pay, but also for the chief officers of the company. And the other one is sort of the audit/finance committee, right? Because then think of like, you know, the board that has a fiduciary obligation to tell the investing public the most honest representation of the company, which is why they're not getting paid a ton on stock, because they don't want to be too incentivized, right, to be independent. So keeping an eye on that is really important, and they work with the, you know, big four auditors or other auditors to make sure everything is copacetic and clean. So it's a very bureaucratic function that they play in that sense too. So those two committees are very consistent in public companies. In private companies, what the biggest differences are, especially a private company that is like, you know, venture backed, pre-IPO, right, and like hasn't exited yet. You'll typically see two functions there. One is the board will help determine hire or fire the CEO, especially if they're a founder. That's always a big turning point for the company.
Yeah.
And the second one being like when to take the company public or get invested in. Like that's a big decision that the CEO should not make independently, right? Yeah. So that's a big thing that the board kind of creates checks in. And then most of the investors in that case, and this is a big negotiating point on any kind of investment round from venture investors, is like, how many board seats does the investor get?
Right.
So you'll see these big VCs, they allocate capital and they sit on board. They allocate capital and they sit on board. It's like, that's their time. And so that's one, they maybe have fewer of these like compensation audit committee challenges and the bureaucracies to deal with. But those are the big challenges that private company boards in a venture-backed stage deal with.
Also in private equity world, right? When they take on private equity money, that comes with board seats and board oversight as well. I mean, typically in a controlling interest a lot of the time. So now the CEO or the founder, if it's kind of middle market especially, reports into their new private equity overlords. All right, so that let's make the jump to the tour. So the new PGA Tour Enterprises board has 13 people on it, right? That includes 4 from the SSG, includes all the player directors, includes Jay Monahan, and the chairman of the new board is John Henry, who is the chairman of Fenway Sports Group. Do I have all that right?
Yeah, that right. I think the one build there is Tiger Woods was added to be a player director for this reason in anticipation of this deal. So that's something that I think is important to call out too.
So there are 7 player directors. No, there are 5.
There's 5. I think there historically have been 4 on the player advisory board, and they added Tiger as a 5th because of the goings on here.
All right. So we'll keep an eye and see how this new structure works. I mean, obviously the PGA Tour as it exists continues to be, where most of the assets sit, and the current, you know, functioning of the tour is governed by the not PGA Tour Enterprises right now. It's the traditional PGA Tour board, which is a nonprofit. So independent directors, Jay, and the player directors. And, you know, I mean, boards, yeah, I haven't read a ton of like business war stories books, but, you know, they're kind of guiding the ship until a storm rolls in, right? And then you've got some, I mean, the 2008 stories about the board meetings and the, you know, like when CEOs of big Fortune 100 companies get canned, it's like a bunch of jets descending in Dallas for like an emergency board meeting, right? On like a Sunday night. So that's where things get pretty juicy. So, you know, there's a lot of value to having a really, you know, intelligent, diverse, you know, different skill sets, different ages, that bring different perspectives. You may not need it on a Tuesday morning, but you know, disruption comes for every business, and a board is pretty valuable in that setting.
Yeah, I want to hone in on one little thing you said pretty much in passing, which is most of the assets will sit with the nonprofit part of this deal. It's funny. I spoke to a common friend of ours.
Well, right now,
and that's I think the key question that a friend of ours, who's at one of these invest PE types who sits on a lot of boards, including chairs a few of them. It's like it all comes down to what assets sit in what part of the structure. Like that's the, like, he's like very, you know, he's not a huge golfer in the track and stuff, but he's like, that's the question. Like he was most curious to ask to and catch up on this stuff is like, that's the determination. Cause there need to be enough assets in the for-profit side to give everyone a return.
Right.
But if you do it too much, then you lose the original structure of the tour. So like that, I haven't seen so much about, but I'm watching that too. So now you've got this like for-profit within a nonprofit. What's the other company you know of recently who's had that structure?
Microsoft OpenAI.
Well, not even Microsoft, just OpenAI itself.
Okay.
But you're right. Like Microsoft did invest in the for-profit. You're correct there. But like even without that, there has been this for-profit within a nonprofit OpenAI for a while. And so folks might remember the saga from last November. Over a weekend, Sam Altman was fired, and then there was this big uprising from his employees. They were all going to quit, and Microsoft was almost going to poach him, and all of a sudden, he's back as the CEO, like all matter of like 4 days, banana stuff. But I heard him in an interview recently where he's like, I would highly recommend on any entrepreneur to start their company. If they want to start their company, just start as a for-profit from the get-go. Don't mess with nonprofit stuff if you have any commercial appetite. I'm sort of paraphrasing the quote, but he was very adamant about, like, in retrospect, that never should have been the deal or never been the structure.
Well, the Course Record Show, we're a for-profit. Started out, you know, we just figured one day this is going to turn into big money and we don't have to have that same problem Sam Altman had. So we're in the clear.
Still waiting for that day, but
it's
not today. But here we are, right?
That's interesting. That is really interesting. And a good analogy, honestly, to the tour. All right. That's the latest in the business of golf. Thanks for listening. Appreciate it. Send it to a friend. Please subscribe. Course Record Show, Roberto and Dan signing off. Thanks, Dan. Good chatting.
See you for episode 35, bud.